Time now for StoryCorps. Today, a look back on the way mental illness was once treated in this country. It comes from John Brock, who spoke with his daughter, Glennie. In 1965, when he was 22, John's behavior started to worry his family. He was brought to Bryce Hospital, Alabama's oldest and largest psychiatric facility, where he was treated for schizophrenia.
At the time, there was a lack of other resources for what a family could do when they had a family member who was not well. Having no other choice, my parents had me committed. I was put into a small room, locked, bars on the door. The doctor told my parents that I was hopelessly insane, that I would never leave Bryce, that they should visit me less. At home, they should speak of me less, and at a point, they should move on with their lives and leave me behind.
Do you remember anything that happened to you in the hospital?
Yes. I began to be given shock treatments. My older sister, Kay, visited, and I spoke with great feeling about it and asked that she have them stop. Kay said that she would, and as the day went on, I spoke with the doctor. I said, "Doctor, I'm not supposed to get a shock treatment today." Permission had been removed by my family. He looked at me and he said, "Get up on the table." And I do remember the slam of the electricity through my head. Some years after, I looked at my psychiatric records and Kay had removed family permission for them to give me shock treatments.
How did you get out?
In a word, I lied. I started studying television programs. I would just watch people, listen to how they interacted. I knew that to the degree that someone seemed normal, the doctors, the nurses, they were more interested in thinking of that person as someone who could leave Bryce Hospital.
Watching how you have lived your life makes me think that it is possible to fight through things and to live. I think it sort of made me brave. Thank you, Dad.
Thank you, Glennie.
John Brock with his daughter, Glennie, in Birmingham, Alabama. John went on to get a master's degree in public administration. Today, he helps patients of Bryce Hospital readjust to life on the outside. All StoryCorps interviews are archived at the Library of Congress, and the podcast is at npr.org.
Major funding for StoryCorps comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from the Atlantic Philanthropies.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What if our gadgets were, well, a little more sensitive? What if they knew that we were getting frustrated or mad or even tired, and they could tailor our experience, whether it's shopping online or driving our cars? They could tailor those experiences to suit our mood, maybe make us a little happier. Or if your car knew your driving habits so well that it could sense when you were getting angry, and it could intervene, sort of like a built-in road rage-o-meter, and keep you from doing something stupid on the highway. Well, scientists at MIT are working on devices, including webcams and special wristbands, that help measure emotions in people. The data they collect might help us make better communicators or drivers. Or maybe the devices could one day help people with emotional or physical problems, like autism, communicate their feelings and needs better to us. What do you think? Would you want your computer or wristband to track your emotions and learn about them and maybe interact better with you or maybe take care of you? Or you think that's an invasion of your privacy? Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Let me introduce my guest. Rosalind Picard is Director of Effective Computing Research and Director of Autism and Communication Technology at the MIT Media Lab. She's also Professor of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT and co-founder and chief scientist at Affectiva. That company is Affectiva Incorporated. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Picard.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Can you describe exactly what emotion sensing is and how our emotions are sensed?
Well, first of all, what we're sensing is some outwardly measurable aspects of emotion, which is not quite the same as knowing what you're really feeling inside. For example, we can, using a camera, recognize your facial expressions. And if you choose to show that you're frustrated or angry or smiling and pleased, then the camera can start to interpret that information and hopefully respond respectfully like a person hopefully would. We can also put a sensor on if you choose. It's all opt-in. And from the surface of your skin, pick up some changes that are happening inside your body. And those can be indicative of some aspects of your emotions changing as well.
What kind of changes would it sense?
Well, the main one that our sensor picks up on now is the electrodermal activity. That's small changes in conductance sensed from the surface of your skin. And those are activated when your sympathetic nervous system, sometimes known as the fight or flight system in your brain, is activated. So when that fires, it affects the innervation of the nerves around the sweat glands under the skin. And even before you sweat, we can pick up those changes.
How different or similar is this to what is being sensed on polygraph tests?
This is one of the signals used in polygraph tests, but it doesn't just change with lying. For example, it can go up with things that you're positively excited about, like getting ready to meet somebody very special to you. It can go up.
And you work with the idea that we might be able to get our machines, which they all have computer chips in them right now, of course, to be able to interact with us better and understand our emotions or things that we're feeling. And you're also looking at it for possibly helping out kids with autism.
Yeah, there are a lot of people for whom our technology is actually useful right now, while the general emotional intelligence of machines still kind of has a ways to go. But right now we have people who are wearing our sensors, say, who are unable to speak and unable to talk about their feelings. And people are kind of trying to guess what's going on by looking at them on the outside, and that's extremely inaccurate. And while the sensor is not a perfect readout of your emotions, it does tell you some changes that you can't always see accurately on the outside, and those can be really valuable.
When you take these measurements, how many do you, how do you calibrate the machine? What's the process that goes on here?
We actually don't have to do any lengthy calibration. You can just put the sensor on and see the level, and then watch how it changes within a person. So when a person's relaxed, it goes down. When they get excited about something, it goes up. So it's pretty easy. Now, people may have different absolute levels, but it's very easy to adjust for those by just looking at them over the course of the day.
Is it easier to tell when someone's getting angry or getting happy?
Interesting. Usually we would look at the face for that. If you're getting really happy, both could be activating for our sensor, anger and happiness. And hopefully the face would tell you if it was positive or negative. However, we just presented some results at a conference I met in California showing that sometimes when people are frustrated, they respond with a happy smile. And that may be a coping mechanism. So it's important to look not just at the smile and not just at the autonomic response.
I've seen commercials recently for automobiles that will detect when you're falling asleep or avoid oncoming objects if you're a little drowsy. Is this that same kind of idea here, at least in that frame reference?
We haven't focused on driver drowsiness, but the same kinds of signals could be used for that, yes. So you could look at things like, are the eyes closing? Is the head falling forward? Is the person's muscle tone kind of fading? And is the skin response, which also shows very interesting patterns during sleep, changing in a way that looks like the person's falling asleep?
Do you find that people are eager to use this, or do they see this perhaps as an invasion of their privacy?
Well, I mean, if somebody forces this on you, I would see it, as an invasion of privacy.
Right.
But our technology is all designed to be opt-in, and you can wear it or not. You can turn your camera on or not. So I would certainly not force this on anybody. I think what we find is a lot of people are very curious about what's going on inside themselves, and they want to try it. And when they see it, they learn things, and that's really helpful to them. So, if you want to learn about yourself, then, give it a try. You can keep the data private, or you can share it with others if you feel you trust them.
And if we wanted to try this, how could we do that?
Well, I'm delighted to say the sensors we've invented at MIT no longer have to be sent out with a grad student and a soldering iron attached. Affectiva is selling them. If you go to affectiva.com, you can learn more about them or mail info at affectiva.com. They are providing the sensors primarily right now for researchers, and we are planning to come out with a consumer version later in the year.
Let's go to Mary in Cincinnati. Hi, Mary. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually like to sing in my car when I'm driving, and, you know, like if it's something that I really enjoy, I might get into it. And I'm wondering if someone were to be singing like an angry song or an emotional song, if the software that you're talking about, you know, interpreting our driving and changing the way our car responds, if that might have a negative, you know, impact or reaction if we're, you know, enjoying the music.
I certainly think we should be very wary of how we have the car respond differently to us in our affective states. Some of the things people have done that I thought were really smart were, for example, if your GPS is talking to you and you're angry, then it better not sound cheery, right? The voice might want to change its tone to be more subdued. On the other hand, if you're, like, really happy, singing, you know, cheery, and the voice reflects that, then it's been shown people actually drive more safely when that voice responds, becoming more cheery when they're cheery or becoming more subdued when they're angry. So that I would see as something that would, you know, improve our performance behind the wheel, and that I would welcome.
That's interesting. Thanks for calling, Mary. Happy singing.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm sure it's disco music. Let me ask you a question, Dr. Picard. If your car, let's take this car example because I think it's fascinating. If your car discovers that you're angry, might it speak up like a friend would say and warn you to calm down a bit, or, you know, you might be on the brink of road rage here, soothing, something like that?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think there's going to be an interaction with personality. If it did that and you didn't like it, it had better not keep doing that, because that could make you angrier and that would make you a less safe driver. I've been told by others that anger equals 3 beers behind the wheel of a car. If you're really angry, don't hop in the car. Do something else for a while. And whatever it takes to get you to calm down would be what we would want to learn how to do to support you if that happened in the car.
Mm-hmm. So you might actually, though, opt in to choose something like that to warn you.
Yeah. If you have a problem, like we're working with people who struggle with emotion dysregulation, whether it's anxiety attacks or panic attacks or cravings that precede substance abuse, and if we can measure that pattern unique to them and understand how to help support them at that moment, then we can, through the mobile device, actually bring them a response to their sensed data that is hopefully helpful for them.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine this would be useful in a shopping situation where...
There are a lot of companies interested in shopping. I know now that we're completely mobile and you can just wear this in regular life, you know, you go in the store and you can see, you know, what makes your signal go up. And usually it's bad stuff. Usually it's something like, you know, one of those frustrating checkout machines that's not, you know, not making sense.
So it detects that you're sitting there frustrated online because the person has 15 items in the 10-item line.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it knows that and it offers you a coupon.
Yeah, actually, we've been looking at ways that, you know, people might be, well, some people just intrinsically want to learn about their data. Other people might be, you know, a little reluctant, like, why would I turn on my camera on the web, you know, when I'm shopping? But if it's just like them looking at you in the store and they give you a coupon, you know, at checkout, why not turn on your camera and let them see that you're confused by the screen that they're showing you at the checkout
mm-hmm.
section?
Yeah, or if you're, you know, you have one of those electronic carts now that have all these TV screens on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe it could detect and then offer you something on that screen or point you to a sale that's going on in the store or something like that.
I'm sorry? What do we do with sales?
Or it could point you to something on sale to make you a little happier, offer you something.
Sure. Yeah. You know, we can easily detect smiles of delight, people walking in and out and looking at things. And certainly if you give people an unexpected surprise that's delightful, they can feel really good about that experience and want to come back and even want to tell others about it.
Yeah, thank you very much for telling us about it.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Take care.
Rosalind Picard is Director of Effective Computing Research and Director of Autism and Communication Technology at that famous MIT Media Lab. She is also Professor of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT and co-founder and chief scientist at Affectiva Incorporated. And she says you can actually experience this for yourself. If you want to find out more about it, you can go to their website and see what it's like to have that kind of interaction. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Lawrence Krauss. Dr. Krauss will be here to talk about his new book, which is The Life and Times of Richard Feynman. And you can call us 1-800-989-8255. The book is called Quantum Man. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll be talking about one of the most interesting physicists of the 20th century. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Right now, one of the new things in mobile phones is 3D, which gives us our last word in business today. Small is beautiful. While 3D TV hasn't exactly been a hit among consumers, mobile phone makers are hoping to score big with 3D phones. LG just unveiled a 3D handset. Sprint has one coming out this summer. One advantage is that these smaller screens don't require special glasses. But you won't be chatting with friends as they pop out of the screen, at least just yet. At the moment, 3D smartphones are aimed at people who like to play video games on their phones. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Our business news is produced by Jessica Smith. Morning Edition is edited by Greg Myrie and Chuck Holmes. The editorial staff includes Shanita Anderson, Ann Hawk, Jordana Hochman, Renita Jablonski, Miranda Kennedy, and Maeve McGoran.
With Nina Gregory here at NPR West. Our senior supervising editors are Kitty Isley and Shannon Rhodes, and our executive producer is Madalika Sicca. The executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. U.S. bombs in Libya have led to a strong response from Capitol Hill. President Obama tried to answer criticism today that he has not consulted with Congress about U.S. action in Libya. He held a conference call with congressional leaders. We're going to talk through some events of the week with our political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Welcome back, E.J.
Good to be here.
And sitting in for David Brooks this week, we're joined by Linda Chavez. She's a syndicated columnist and chairwoman of the Center for Equal Opportunity. Hello to you, Linda.
Hello to you.
And let's talk about the back and forth about who will command the mission in Libya. NATO now preparing to take over the no-fly operation after much back and forth on that. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talked about that last night. Let's take a listen.
In the days ahead, as NATO assumes command and control responsibilities, the welfare of those civilians will be of paramount concern.
E.J. Dionne, do you think there is any way to fulfill this mission of protecting civilians without getting enmeshed in a civil war in Libya?
I hope so, and I think so. I mean, we've already done something very important, I think, which is to prevent what could have been a real slaughter of the rebels in Benghazi. And I think that when we look back, we will be glad, we Americans, who are involved in this coalition will be glad we have done that. But it's very hard to figure out where the end game of this is. My Washington Post colleague, Gene Robinson, wrote this morning that a lot of people, including him and myself included, are confused about the rationale, goals, tactics, and strategy here. It's hard to know exactly where this ends. And I think that's where the president can do some more explaining.
Well, Linda Chavez, on that point, I mean, has the president muddied the waters by saying at the same time that we're there to protect civilians that also Gaddafi must go?
Well, I think that is part of the problem. I think our aims are not clearly defined there. And part of the problem was we dithered for a while, and it would have been a lot easier, I think, 3 weeks earlier had we gone in. Now we do actually have a full-fledged on-the-ground civil war going on between rebels and Gaddafi's forces that had time to move into areas that they might not otherwise had it. We've been a little bit faster on the draw. On the other hand, the president really does not seem to have shown the kind of willingness to come out and explain to Congress and to the American people. I mean, that's one of the most important things. When you send Americans into a battle, even if they're up at, 40,000 miles in the sky, 40,000 feet in the sky.
there are 40,000 miles we really have to worry.
You're still risking lives, and we did lose a plane. And so I think he really does owe to the American people coming out and telling us what we're there for, what we hope to accomplish. And regime change, I think many people would like to see that, but we have to know what's going to follow.
But one person's dithering is another person's caution. And I think that what he has done here that is right and will serve us well is that we went in with a large coalition of our allies, and that we're not doing this alone. There is a lot of support for going after, at least stopping Gaddafi. And so there were costs to delay, but I think there were some real benefits to the way he approached it.
There was a letter waiting for President Obama when he got back from his Latin America trip from Speaker John Boehner, Speaker of the House, wondering about a number of questions. Among them, were military resources committed to war without clearly defining what the mission is? And do you think, Linda Chavez, that this conference call with Republican leaders and Democratic leaders today goes some distance in resolving those questions?
Well,
I
think
it's too little, too late.
It's the beginning of a conversation. But, of course, the problem is that we were busy consulting with the Arab League. We were, in fact, pursuing action in the United Nations, but we weren't talking to members of Congress. And I think that is a problem for President Obama. And I think he does have to mend some fences. And certainly the irony is that it's probably going to be the Republicans who are going to be, you know, the biggest supporters of military action, and his own Democrats who may, in fact, be less willing to support. So he should not be alienating them in this process.
EJ?
Well, I think some Republicans would be against anything that Obama did. Indeed, although he claims he was consistent, Newt Gingrich seemed to be against him when he was acting and when he wasn't acting. But I think that what you're seeing here is a very different kind of foreign policy array of positions, because I think liberals are split between those who are very uneasy with intervention altogether and those who support humanitarian intervention. I think you're also seeing the reemergence of an isolationist or a non-interventionist wing of the Republican Party. They were kind of under wraps under Bush, and they really didn't challenge intervention much. Now that Obama's president, they are out there expressing what I suspect was their view back when President Bush was in office.
I want to talk to you both about new census data that came out this week that show a dramatic jump in the Hispanic population of the country, up from 35 million in 2000, now up to 50 million. Hispanics now make up 16% of the population. And if you look at the population younger than 18, it's actually 23%. EJ, lots of implications of this, but one of them is political. What do you see the impact being?
We've already seen a lot of impact. For example, if you look at where there are large Latino populations, California was pushed from being a swing state to being a solidly Democratic state by the Latino population. Colorado and Florida were pushed from Republican-leaning states to being swing states, especially Florida. And if you look at the nine states where the Latino population more than doubled, one of the important ones is North Carolina. That Latino vote helped Barack Obama carry North Carolina. The other sphere I think they're going to be important in is labor. That we're celebrating or honoring this week the Triangle Shirtwaist fire in New York, where so many immigrant workers were killed. It led to reform of workplace safety laws and spurred the trade union movement. I think if unions are going to make a comeback in the country, Latinos are going to be in the vanguard, as they have been in both California and New York.
And Linda Chavez, this is something you've been writing about for some time now. What do you see with these new numbers?
Well, it's very interesting. In fact, there has been this big increase, and it's driven by two factors. One is immigration, both legal and illegal, but also by higher birth rates among Hispanics. Even college-educated Hispanics tend to have more children than comparably educated non-Hispanic whites. And so you have seen this burgeoning. But I think what EJ is talking about in terms of the political influence is going to be very interesting, because they were, in fact, Hispanics were, in fact, very instrumental in the 2008 election. I think they were part of, Obama's success was a bigger than average Hispanic turnout. But President Obama has not delivered on immigration reform, and I think there are many in the Latino community who are not happy about that. He went off for this little tour in South America, but he hasn't delivered the goods on immigration, so they may not show up come November 2012.
Okay. Linda Chavez, E.J. Dionne, thanks to you both. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Linda Chavez is a syndicated columnist and chairwoman of the Center for Equal Opportunity. E.J. Dionne is a columnist with The Washington Post.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. As the radiation spreads from the crippled Japanese nuclear plant, a global network of sensors is tracking it across oceans and continents. The network was originally set up to detect nuclear weapons testing. Scientists now hope it can tell them more about the accident in Japan. Jeff Brumfiel is a reporter with the scientific journal Nature. He's been covering the nuclear emergency.
The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization began setting up its monitoring stations about a decade ago. The eventual goal is to enforce a worldwide ban on nuclear weapons tests. Here's spokesperson Annika Thurberry.
We have currently over 280 sensors worldwide monitoring underground, the atmosphere, the oceans for any sign of a nuclear explosion, and we're also sniffing the air for any sign of radioactivity.
That now includes radioactivity from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Explosions at three reactors and a fire at a spent fuel pool have released radiation into the atmosphere. Gerhard Votova is with the Austrian Meteorological Service and has been studying data coming from the monitoring stations. He says there's no doubt what they're picking up is coming from Japan.
Data like that, I mean, I've never seen it in my career, so it is pretty much clear where it comes from.
The sensors are registering radioactive elements like iodine-131 and cesium-137. These are byproducts from nuclear fission inside the core of a reactor. Votova has been feeding the data into computer models that can forecast where the radiation will go. He also uses the models to work backwards and calculate the amount of material first released. Based on those calculations, he says the accident, in some ways, is roughly the size of Chernobyl.
The daily release is comparable with what was set free in Chernobyl. Yeah? However, the effect of the power plant accident to Japan is not comparable with the effect of the Chernobyl accident to the former Soviet Union.
That's partly because Chernobyl was located inland and radiation contaminated land in all directions. Fukushima is on the coast, and winds are blowing much of the material out over the Pacific. Votova's calculations are just an estimate, and not everyone agrees the accident is comparable to Chernobyl.
If I had to guess, I would say that the release levels were more like Three Mile Island and less like Chernobyl, but we'll see as time goes forward.
Harry Miley is a nuclear physicist at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Washington State. He says analyzing the types and amounts of radioactive material picked up by the sensor network will tell researchers around the world more about what happened inside the reactors at Fukushima.
We might determine things like what was the temperature of the material when the radioactivity was emitted, which materials it was. There's three reactors and there's spent fuel pools and so forth. They're all potential sources, and we should be able to nail down which source is which.
For now, it may be the only way to tell what's happened. Radiation levels on the site are far too high to take a direct look. The sensors should also provide people with a sense of reassurance. Even though the radiation from the plant has been picked up across the United States, Miley says that the levels aren't dangerous.
The highest detection that we've gotten in the U.S. has been far lower than the natural radioactivity that's normally there. So I don't think that there's any increased risk to the U.S. public.
And there's more good news. The latest readings here in America seem to indicate that radiation from the plant is falling. Miley is hopeful that the worst of the accident may be behind us. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.